This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. If you're a basketball fan, you can thank Oscar Robertson for today's game. In 14 years with the Cincinnati Royals and the Milwaukee Bucks, Oscar Robertson elevated the sport and carved a new place for the role of the guard. Part of what makes a player great are his rivals, Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain, Magic Bird and Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. And listen now as commentators Keith Jackson and Bill Russell describe a confrontation between Jerry West and Oscar Robertson.
Take another look at the foul as Jerry West tries to control Oscar. Bill, you get the feeling, you can almost sense when Oscar is determined to take it to the basket.
Yes, you can see it in the backcourt. It's almost, you can see it in his eyes. He makes up his mind pretty much what he's going to do in the backcourt.
You see, he's an average, you see, scoring less, but doing more things like Jerry West is doing for Los Angeles. Makes the two free throws. Robertson and West. Oscar shoots.
Offer. Nothing to do with that. Just call it cry for help. Help.
That's right, just yell. Lean back and holler as loud as you can.
Keith Jackson and Bill Russell describing Oscar Robertson on the court. He joins us now from our bureau in New York to talk about his new autobiography, The Big O, My Life, My Times, My Game. And Oscar Robertson, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me here today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to have you. And listeners, if you have questions for Oscar Robertson, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And listening to that clip of tape, was Jerry West your greatest rival?
One of them. There are several for me. Russell, Chamberlain, Bob Pettit, Elgin Baylor, all great basketball players in their own right.
He played your position, though.
Yes, Jerry did. Yes, he did.
And those other guys, you might see them going by every once in a while, but it wasn't quite the same.
Well, but it's in a way, but basketball in those days was such that you didn't just play against one person all the time because you switched off so many times, you were double-teamed so many times, and oftentimes you'd cut under the basket against a Russell or Chamberlain or Elgin Baylor or Bob Pettit. So you had to have the skills in order to keep them away from the ball if you were on defense.
One of the things you write about is growing up, you weren't all that big when you started playing basketball, and you learned the skills of a guard before you grew into your body.
Yeah, one year after my freshman year, I was maybe about 5'8", I believe, or 7". And what happened, I went to Tennessee to work on my father's little farm. She was a sharecropper there in Tennessee, where he sharecropped just for his animals and whatnot, but he had maybe 10 or 12 acres of land himself. And I grew about 6 to 7 inches. And I really didn't know it myself until I came back to Cincinnati. And there one guys I went to school with kept looking at and said, "What in the world happened to you?"
Now, you grew up, as you mentioned, in rural Tennessee and then later Indianapolis. Tell us, if you would, about the first ball you ever played with, the first basketball.
The first actual ball I ever played with, my mother got for me. She was domestic working in Cincinnati. She also was a beautician. And she brought this ball home one day because prior to that, I just used sock balls and imaginary balls to shoot at a hoop and whatnot and yell good when I'd shoot with 10 seconds on the clock and I'd always make it, of course, but in those situations like that. But she finally got me a ball, and I was very happy about that ball. I loved it.
You write that in a way, growing up and playing on the courts there, the Dust Bowl, you describe the court that it was originally known, and then a move over some asphalt courts, and that was called the Dust Bowl, too. But that basketball was a way for you to find yourself, to establish an identity.
I think when you're in a situation where there's no money to do anything and to go anywhere, see anyone, travel, you have to gravitate to something that you love, and sports was something great for me, especially basketball. I played all sports, really, but, it takes your mind away from a lot of things, a lot of the bad things. I didn't realize that people had air conditioning when I first moved to Indianapolis, Indiana. Those types of things. It's just amazing. You used to always look up and see airplanes go by, and I said, what in the world are those people? Who are they? Where are they going? I just couldn't imagine anyone getting on an airplane to go anywhere, because I never had an opportunity to go anywhere. Did I know where to go if I could have gone anywhere?
You also write a lot about racism and how it's influenced your life and all of our lives in a way, but your life in particular. And one of the things you describe is, in effect, you didn't meet any white people until you were in high school.
That's correct. There were a few my grandfather knew in Tennessee working in the bottom lands. One was named, I believe, Blake Spann. Felix Duncan. I didn't really see any other whites at all. When I went to school in Indianapolis, Indiana, it was totally all black and had a wonderful time. Great teachers, teachers who had the doctors, but they could not teach in the white schools. I thought this was the greatest part of my time in my life, to be honest.
It was a segregated school. And
oh, of course.
Yeah. And you also write that this might not be a popular opinion, but you thought you did better at a segregated school.
I thought I did because I was a little shy initially. I didn't have to worry about the peer group pressures from teachers in an all-white situation or the students. I could be myself. I had an older brother, two older brothers, and went to school there. But the teachers were like parents who taught me the best way out of a situation that I was involved in and where I lived was through education.
Hmm. Those of us who did not grow up in Indiana know what we know about the passions of people there for the game of basketball, largely from the movie Hoosiers. And you were part of that tournament.
I was part of that tournament. As a matter of fact, that team, the Milan, beat us when I was a sophomore. And they went on to play in the tournament against a team called Muncie Central, who should have won the basketball game.
Mm-hmm.
But as fate has it, sometimes in sports, those things happen. But the movie itself portrayed Milan as playing against an all-black team, which is totally untrue. Totally untrue.
So that should be important in our minds. My recollection of that movie, the other team, was that it was mixed, that it was some black players and some white players.
No, you saw they had a black coach.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, my brother was one of the assistants on that team in the movie. But really, it was a team from Muncie Central where they had two African-Americans on the team.
I see.
But it was a very, very good basketball team.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Oscar Robertson is with us from our bureau in New York. And let's go to Mark, who's with us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Robertson, it's a great pleasure to speak with you. I grew up in Southern Ohio and had the pleasure of watching you play growing up. And I just wanted to know what you felt was your greatest challenge that you had to overcome in the NBA.
I think my greatest challenge was myself, to begin with, to be able to understand what to do and when to do it. I was not intimidated by anyone because I played so much basketball. You know, the nervousness left many, many years ago when I was in high school. But that was a big challenge for me, to understand and let the game come to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. Like I said, it was a pleasure to watch you play, and it was a great time.
Thank you very much.
You, Oscar Robertson, compare basketball to jazz, and I guess jazz musicians have pretty much the same problem of knowing what to do and when.
Well, I love jazz. As a matter of fact, that's when I first started in pro basketball. A friend of mine was involved in jazz records, so I got a lot of jazz records. I still have a great collection of jazz records. But, you know, the people in jazz, you know, improvised a lot. You know, they were not on a mainstream avenue, a one-way street or anything. They went here, they went there, and all of a sudden when they felt they had to get into another gear, they could get there. And basketball the same way. You know, you play on a certain level. All of a sudden, competition comes from someone on the court board. You pick it up, and then the great stars are able to go pick it up even higher than that, and that's where you go on to win victory.
We're speaking with Oscar Robertson, the basketball great. His book is titled appropriately, "The Big O." You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News, and let's get a caller in. John is on the line with us from Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Boy, what a thrill, Neil, to talk to the big O.
Tell me about
Thank
it.
You.
Just old enough, Oscar, to remember you when I was a kid coming into Kiel Auditorium and playing.
Oh, Lord, St. Louis, Missouri.
You bet. You played against Zelmo Beatty and Bob Pettit and Richie Guerin and Joe Caldwell, and I've gotten to meet Bob Gibson and Jimmy Brown in my life, and I hope I get to meet you. I had two quick questions, Oscar. Could you tell us about, didn't you play in the Olympics, and what was that like, and if you were the commissioner of the NBA or the NCAA, would you keep the three-point arc or would you abandon the three-point arc?
Okay, John, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Oscar and Neil.
Thank you. Well, one, the Olympics was satisfying, very, very satisfying for me to be able to play for my country at a particular time when you know, we were going through a lot of social change then, coming out of the 50s into the 60s. I thought that I was a fortunate individual to be able to be born in Tennessee, grew up in Indianapolis, go to the University of Cincinnati and to be able to try out for the team, not knowing whether I would make it or not. But unfortunately for me, I didn't make the basketball team, and very happy to still have the gold medal, which I'm very proud of.
Hmm. And the other question about the three-point arc?
Well, it's here to stay. I mean, there's nothing I can do about it. I mean, I think it's terrible myself. I don't think it's all that great a thing. Guys shoot less than 35% from there. You lose. There have been a few games won. There have also been some games lost. And if you play fundamental basketball where you go and take the best shot, this may not have happened, and it might have, but you never know. It's here, whether I like it or not. I'm not that crazy about it. I think it's just like anything that that we do after a while in our life. It's so great, then why change it?
Well, let's get another caller on. Now, this is RJ in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to Mr. Robertson. I was a fanatic basketball fan when I grew up and played it and loved it. And I grew up in Boston, and there were some great rivalries with the Celtics and the Cincinnati Royals. But my question is, Mr. Robertson alluded earlier to a sense that when he was playing basketball, that he was content and happy. It was a thing that gave him happiness and peace. And it's kind of a spiritual thing. My question is, do you see now where the money has gotten so big and the advertisers and the television and all that, that a sense of that has been taken away when, in essence, what's happening now is they're hyping the hype. There's just this tremendous hype of all these activities, the professional sports.
I think you're right about what you're saying. You look at the situation that happened just not recently, I should say, between Denver with Carmelo Anthony and Cleveland with LeBron James.
These are two of the three high draft picks in last year's draft, great players. But go ahead.
Whereby the NBA and our news people, someone, somehow, some way, thought they were going to go out and just sell it. This is the greatest rivalry going. These competitors are going to be combatants. They're going to fight to the finish. Boy, what a dud. this is what happens today. You look at a situation today with owners who are willing to pay more than millions of dollars to a basketball player to play a game that you really should play for little or nothing. And they're willing to do this, but they complain about it. They complain about the money in itself, and I think that's wrong to do. We live in times where everything is going to cost more. I remember the first car I ever bought, and it cost me, what, $500, $300? You know, you couldn't even get your brakes fixed for $300 anymore. That's the way things are, you know. I mean, we're in times now where it's marketing. It's not about the competitors or just playing to win sometime, because I feel that only maybe four or five or six teams can actually have a chance to win.
I remember a time in the NBA, there was a Mr. Glickman was the...
Marty Glickman.
Marty Glickman, yeah.
Was a great announcer, and it would come on a little black and white TV that I'd watch on Saturday afternoons. And I look back on that as like almost prehistory now.
It probably was prehistory. Marty Glickman was a tremendous radio announcer, really.
Oh, it was the best.
And do you know the story about Marty Glickman?
No, sir.
He's the reason Jesse Owens got to run in the Olympics in 1936 because Hitler didn't want Marty Glickman, because he was Jewish, to participate in. And Avery Brundage, who was running the Olympic Committee during those times, he felt the same way.
Yeah. Oh, one more comment, quickly. Mr. Robertson, people like yourself and Bill Russell, I know they put up with a lot of bad stuff, and they did it with just a sense of, you know, almost saintliness, because the treatment they got at that time was just horrible. I mean, Bill Russell would talk about people saying things to him. I just couldn't believe it, that he had to put up with stuff like that.
Well, it happens, but, you know, you get over it. You know, growing up in the South, you're not naive about anything going on, really. As a matter of fact, you know a lot more than people give you credit for. And some things that you can't do, if you can't go into a place or you can't drink at a fountain, it became part of your life, so you didn't expect to do those things.
If you ever question what kind of a player Oscar Robertson was, one of the acmes of the game today is to score a triple-double to get three two-digit statistics in one game, generally assists, scoring, and rebounding. Over the course of one season, Oscar Robertson averaged a triple-double. In fact, if you extend his statistics over 5 years, he averaged a triple-double over 5 years. And in fact, he didn't know it, because they didn't keep those statistics in those days.
That's true.
Mr. Robertson, thank you very much for coming in. It's been a great pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oscar Robertson's new book is The Big O, My Life, My Times, My Game. He joined us from our bureau in New York. Ira Flatow is here tomorrow with Science Friday. We'll see you Monday. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.